From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, April 17, 2009. The Obama administration reveals Bush-era torture memos, but says it won't prosecute those who used the techniques to interrogate prisoners. The president wraps up his trip to Mexico and heads to his first Summit of the Americas. And we'll go to Kabul, where people have taken to the streets over a new law that decrees women can be forced by their husbands to have sex. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Ian Tomlinson, the man who died minutes after being shoved to the ground by police at the G20 summit in London, did not die of a heart attack as originally thought. The postmortem findings released by a British investigative body today show Tomlinson died of abdominal hemorrhaging, making the connection between the officer's action and Tomlinson's death much stronger. Authorities say they have questioned the officer on suspicion of manslaughter. President Obama's visit to Mexico City focused more on symbolism than action. The president attempted to reshape the unequal and often rocky relationship between the closely connected countries. Trevor Snapp has more from Mexico City.
In an important gesture from Mexico, Obama emphasized the role the U.S. plays in drug violence, which has taken 10,000 lives here since President Calderon launched the countrywide assault in 2006.
But I will not pretend that this is Mexico's responsibility alone. A demand for these drugs in the United States is what is helping to keep these cartels in business. This war is being waged with guns purchased not here, but in the United States. More than 90% of the guns recovered in Mexico come from the United States, many from gun shops that line our shared border. So we have responsibilities as well.
Obama announced he would ask the Senate to ratify an inter-American weapons treaty, but did not call for the ban on assault rifles that President Calderon was hoping for. Overall, many Mexicans are skeptical of U.S. intentions. Taxi driver Guillermo Paz said the visit would change nothing, citing the U.S. decision to stop Mexican trucks from entering the U.S.
En la historia, si hay un país que no respeta ningún tratado, son los Estados Unidos.
If there is one country that never respects a treaty, it is the U.S. They won't let our trucks pass. So why do they come if they just do what they want? For this reason, I don't think they will solve anything. If one party does not respect the other, then we will never have agreements.
Si son dos partes las que firman y uno respeta y el otro no, nunca va a haber acuerdo.
For FSRN, this is Trevor Snapp in Mexico City.
Israeli soldiers killed a Palestinian man and injured dozens more today during a nonviolent protest. The protest has been happening on a weekly basis for 4 years in the Belen village near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. It often attracts Palestinian, Israeli, and other international activists. Ghassan Benoura of IMEMC.org reports.
Local sources said 30-year-old Basim Ibrahim Abu Rahma died when soldiers shot him in the chest with a tear gas bomb. Abdullah Abu Rahma from the local committee against the wall and settlements witnessed the soldiers' attack.
As is the case each week, we did our protest. Basim was in the front line. We arrived at the wall, and as soon as we tried to cross our lands, the soldiers showered us with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. Basim was shouting at the soldiers that it was a peaceful protest and that there were children present. Before he could finish, soldiers shot him in the chest with a heavy gas bomb, which caused him to bleed to death.
Protesters in Bel'in village held banners condemning Israel's ongoing policies and violence against civilians. They also demanded the release of Palestinian political prisoners held by the Israeli army. In addition to the fatal shooting, Israel fire hit an international supporter in the head. The activist sustained moderate wounds and dozens more were treated for gas inhalation. Ghassan Banoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
The Environmental Protection Agency made a historic announcement today. They declared greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane contribute to air pollution and may be a threat to public health. The announcement today is a culmination of a review ordered by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2007. The review also states that climate change can impact human health in significant ways and would affect poor, elderly, and other vulnerable populations disproportionately. The EPA statement clears the way for governmental regulation of greenhouse gases. A federal court in Atlanta has rejected an appeal from death row inmate Troy Davis. In the appeal, Davis sought a retrial after being convicted of killing a police officer in Savannah in 1989. Since the original conviction, seven witnesses have recanted their testimony, and another man told several people he was actually responsible for the shooting. Amnesty International USA Director Larry Cox says the decision is an affront to basic human rights, and the courts are prioritizing procedure over the issue of innocence. The Atlanta Supreme Court did grant Davis an additional 30-day stay of execution so he can pursue his claim before the U.S. Supreme Court. A Texas court has okayed U.S.-Mexico border wall construction on a South Texas woman's property. Ansel Herz reports.
A federal judge ruled late yesterday in favor of the Department of Homeland Security in its suit against Dr. Eloisa Thomas. Thomas is an indigenous landowner, a member of the Lipan Apache tribe, and her family has owned the land for centuries. Judge Andrew Hannon ruled in March that DHS must negotiate with landowners before property can be seized, but the court's decision held that sufficient negotiations had taken place and Thomas was ordered to allow DHS to start construction on her land. Dr. Thomas told FSRN that she is disappointed with the ruling but will continue speaking out. She said she has seen nothing to indicate President Obama will change the border wall policy, especially since wall construction is providing jobs in the area. Thomas believes she can still appeal the ruling, but says Homeland Security contractors have already been trespassing on areas of her land. Ansel Herz, FSRN, Austin.
Activists in West Virginia are protesting mountaintop removal mining. The mine in question is Massey Energy's coal mine near the town of Neoma, south of the capital, Charleston. During a nonviolent action yesterday, activists unveiled a four-story-high banner in the mine calling on the EPA to stop mountaintop removal. Charles Suggs is one of the activists who participated. He says the mine's coal slurry pond is dangerously close to a local elementary school.
We don't need to see something like what happened with the TVA coal ash disaster in late December. There's a coal preparation plant that's also part of this mine, and that preparation plant, they subject the coal to a huge host of toxic chemicals. Chemical-laden coal dust floats on the air to the school that is 300 feet away from this coal silo. And so it's a microcosm of mountaintop removal as a whole.
Police cited the group with trespassing. This was the fifth action in 3 months targeting the Massey mine. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
The National Security Agency spied on the communications of people living in the U.S. at a level far exceeding the broad guidelines set by Congress. Several intelligence officials told the New York Times that the agency was significantly over-collecting emails and phone calls, even in recent months. The Justice Department says it only sought renewal of the surveillance program after new safeguards were put in place. The activities are under review. The Justice Department has been praised for its release Thursday of Bush-era torture memos. Human rights advocates say it illustrates the Obama administration's commitment to transparency, but as FSRN's Tanya Snyder reports, they also wish the administration was more willing to bring those responsible to justice.
Just when we thought we knew everything there was to know about detainee interrogation methods under Bush, now there's more. The American Civil Liberties Union got four memos released, written by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, outlining in meticulous detail the kinds of interrogation techniques the CIA could use on terrorism suspects. They include waterboarding, slamming prisoners up against walls, sleep deprivation, and confining people terrified of insects in tiny spaces with bugs. The memos were written between August 2002 and May 2005.
I think what's new is how explicit they are and how detailed. These are going down to how many minutes particular practices can be done, who has to be present, and then went into extraordinary detail on explaining things like how someone would be waterboarded.
Christopher Anders is general counsel at the ACLU. He says these memos show a clear line of command all the way up to the White House.
They are written by the Office of Legal Counsel, and they were directed to the general counsel of the CIA. But the path from one to the other leads through the White House. The CIA cannot go directly and get an opinion from the Office of Legal Counsel. They can only get that through the White House.
Attorney General Holder said that CIA officials who relied in good faith on authoritative legal advice from the Justice Department would not face federal prosecution for their conduct. But John B. Good of Amnesty International says Holder left a loophole.
Based off of what he said, people who were the sort of architects of the legal reasoning, as well as higher level officials, could be, you know, potentially prosecuted. I mean, I think there's essentially a mixed set of messages coming from the Obama administration. Obama had said something along the lines of, you know, that no one's above the law, and if there are clear instances of wrongdoing, that people should be prosecuted just like, you know, ordinary citizens.
The ACLU and Amnesty would both like to see prosecutions of those responsible for designing and carrying out the policy of torturing prisoners. But Meredith Fuchs, general counsel of the National Security Archive, a nonprofit dedicated to government openness, says just releasing the documents is a huge step.
Just getting the information out there has a big impact, because getting the information out there reminds every single person who's making these kinds of decisions that they can't keep it covered and secret forever. And knowing that should actually help improve the way people make the decisions and what choices they make, whether to torture or whether to follow approved methods.
If the Obama administration does decide to press charges, either against CIA officials who went beyond the scope of the activities outlined in the memos or against those who authored the policy itself, they'll have to start soon. The statute of limitations for torture is only 8 years, and the first memo was written almost 7 years ago. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
President Obama travels today to the Summit of the Americas in Trinidad and Tobago, where he will meet with 33 leaders from the hemisphere. That meeting won't include Cuba's Raul Castro. The tiny island nation was barred from the Organization of American States in 1962 after the Cuban Revolution. Many of those in attendance are left-leaning Latin American presidents, including Hugo Chavez, Lula da Silva, Michelle Bachelet, and Evo Morales. And while Cuba will not be directly represented, its presence will be known at the summit. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today welcomed President Castro's comments that he's ready to begin talks with the U.S., including on the topic of human rights. Obama takes off to Trinidad from Mexico, where he met with his counterpart, President Felipe Calderon, on Thursday on a state visit thick with symbolic diplomacy. Obama and Calderon sought to establish a common agenda and a shared responsibility on combating the narco-fueled violence that's plaguing Mexico after 8 years of neglect under the Bush administration. 10,000 people have died in the violence since Calderon, a conservative, dispatched the Mexican military to fight the country's major drug trafficking organizations. Daniel Hernandez is in Mexico City, where he caught up with Congress member and vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus, Javier Becerra, one of a handful of lawmakers accompanying Obama on this trip to Latin America and the Caribbean. Hernandez asked the Congress member what Obama's administration hopes to attain from this trip to Mexico.
The president is hoping to walk away from this trip with a clear sense that he is asking the Americas to engage in a new relationship with the U.S. And I think he's hoping to get the offer accepted by each and every country that goes to the summit. And certainly by being here in Mexico, I think he's making it very clear that he recognizes the great importance that Mexico plays, not just within the Americas, but in this relationship between the two countries, the U.S. and Mexico. So I don't think he's trying to come out with these massive deliverables where you've got some major accord in place that changes the world overnight. I think what he's trying to do is say, I want to learn, I want to listen, and I want you to know that I consider you an equal partner.
The White House signaled recently its desire to push for immigration reform sooner than many of us expected. What will your role be in that policy effort? And what can Mexicans in Mexico, as well as in the United States, expect from this go-around after the last couple of efforts have essentially failed to achieve immigration reform?
First, I'm delighted that this president surprises so many people on a constant basis. That's clearly a sign of someone who's looking for change, clearly a sign of someone who thinks outside the box. And I also think it's a clear sign of someone who wants to be courageous in a position of leadership. What it means for me to see President Obama talk so early in his tenure about immigration reform when he's got enough to keep his plate busy for the next 8 years is that I see, one, a man who wants to keep a promise that he made about dealing with a broken immigration system. Two, someone who I think innately, naturally, comes to the issue of immigration as the son of an immigrant and recognizes that we can't continue to allow this broken system to persist. And finally, I think what this means for all of us, whether in the U.S. or outside the U.S., is that we may finally have a chance to tackle this despite the recent failures under a previous Congress and previous administration to try to deal with this issue. I think Barack Obama's president brings a different feel for these issues, and I think he brings a lot of determination and courage to try to get these things done.
The Mexican government since 06 has more or less militarized the effort against the narco cartels, and that's resulted in 10,000 deaths in this span. And there's fear in some sectors that a kind of process of militarization could happen on the American side of the border. And we're sort of trying to figure out what the U.S. will do on the U.S. side 2 years after the effort started on the Mexican side. And what will we see differently from the American side that has been done on the U.S. side?
I honestly believe that our government's approach to this issue will not come from simply a military outlook on how to deal with drugs. I think you're going to see an effort to invest in the people of Mexico so that they are able to work their way out of poverty, which will give them other alternatives than to turning to the easy course of helping the narco traffickers. But you've got to recognize and acknowledge that part of this problem is violent. When the local police, even the state police, are outgunned by the narco traffickers, you really have no choice but to turn to a more heavy military presence and a solution that includes the military aspect to it. We happen to have technologies and experiences that can be very edifying for the Mexicans. And for that reason, I think we have to use every tool at our disposal. For every Mexican police officer who dies, we better be prepared to give them a whole lot of our resources and intelligence and knowledge, because we're consuming those drugs that are causing a lot of these Mexican soldiers and officers to give their life. And so we have to be there in that fight. And the fight is not just one that's economic. It's a military fight as well. I don't think the Mexican people or the Mexican government wants to turn this into a war. But by God, they are in a fight for their life against these narco-traffickers.
Congressman Javier Becerra, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Daniel.
And that was Daniel Hernandez speaking with Congressmember Javier Becerra. The Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas, or ALBA for its Spanish acronym, was created 5 years ago between Cuba and Venezuela as an option to the U.S.-backed free trade area of the Americas. Since its founding, three more nations have joined, and ALBA has implemented numerous social programs and cooperation agreements, including the recently founded ALBA Bank. On Thursday, in advance of the Summit of the Americas, Latin America's most progressive governments met in Venezuela at the 7th ALBA Summit. There, they prepared their positions for the Trinidad Summit and signed the decree for a new South American currency. Mike Fox has more from Cumaná, Venezuela.
In his opening comments, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez criticized the handling of the economic crisis and set the theme of the day-long ALBA Summit.
No debemos esperar nada.
We shouldn't expect anything except from ourselves, from our own hands and our own will and our own courage. That's where we'll find the solution to our problems. Magic solutions aren't going to come from the North, and much less through the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Only a few hours later, the Latin American president signed into effect a new South American currency to be called the Sucre, again President Chavez.
I sincerely believe that this initiative is writing a new page in history. Here in ALBA, we came to take action to confront the economic and social crisis.
Progressive leaders say the Sucre is necessary to help defray the regional effects of the world economic crisis by substituting their trade in dollars with this new alternative currency. The ALBA countries and their allies plan to begin using the virtual Sucre by early next year. The economic crisis, this weekend's Summit of the Americas, and the role of the United States in Latin America were also discussed. Cuban President Raul Castro lashed out at recent comments by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who said the U.S. would consider lifting the Cuban embargo if Cuba released dissidents from prison and embraced democracy. Castro said they are willing to discuss everything, but the U.S. has conditions and won't respect Cuban sovereignty. All in attendance supported Cuba's stance, including Paraguay's new president, Fernando Lugo, who was invited to partake in the meeting, although his country is not yet an ALBA nation.
We are in a new moment in Latin America, and we are the true authors of our own destiny. And there is no nation in the world that can judge us over who is more democratic or not. We each have our own unique process of democratization.
Bolivian President Evo Morales proposed that the ALBA nations present a resolution at the Trinidad summit to ask the United States to end its embargo on Cuba and to cease intervening in Latin American affairs.
Cuba has the support of everyone in the world, except the United States and Israel. So if Obama wants the whole world's support, he is going to have to lift the embargo on Cuba.
Morales also condemned the Human Rights Council of the UN and the Organization of American States, which he said only criticized the region's progressive governments. He called for the creation of an ALBA Commission on Human Rights to carry out its own investigations into human rights violations and destabilization attempts against their countries. After signing the Sucre legislation, the heads of state rushed to a public event in Cumaná's Ayacucho Plaza, where they were greeted by thousands of cheering Venezuelans. Among those in the crowd was Victor Valdiviez. He was there with 24 Bolivian colleagues who are studying in Venezuela as part of ALBA agreements between the two nations.
It has been very beneficial to us. For example, in my case, I am from a province in Bolivia where the doors were locked to me. I was afraid of the camera. But today, I can express myself thanks to the ALBA agreement that I am studying.
The ALBA heads of state traveled to Trinidad and Tobago today, but left behind government representatives in Cumaná to work on the details. Both Cuba and the international crisis are expected to be hot topics at the Trinidad and Tobago summit, but with a heavy U.S. agenda, the ALBA nations don't have high hopes, and President Chavez has already threatened to abstain from signing the final Summit of the Americas document. Mike Fox, FSRN, Cumaná.
A debate has spilled into the streets of Afghanistan over a controversial new law that says a woman must have sex with her husband whenever he demands it. Supporters call it the family law, while critics call it the rape law. Zubair Babakar Kale reports from Kabul.
Hundreds of Shiite men and women staged a silent demo in front of Khatamun Nabiyyin Educational Center, carrying signs saying they will not accept any amendment in their new law. These protesters were there to support the new so-called personal law. But in Kabul, several hundred Afghan women were protesting the Shiite family law, which states that women must have sex with their husbands every 4 days. Angry supporters of the law, both men and women, surrounded the protesters as they marched to the parliament, calling them whores and smashing the taillights of a bus that had carried them to the city. Thirty-five-year-old Amina Masoom, a mother of three wearing a black Islamic hijab, says they support the new law.
We are Muslims and accept our new law. Those people who are against it are sold out to the West. Those who are against the law can come negotiate with us.
The family law contains 253 articles, 13 of which pertain specifically to members of Shia sect. Of biggest concern is the stipulation that women must submit to their husband's demands for sex unless she is sick or could be harmed by intercourse, and the instruction that a woman cannot leave her home without permission from a man. Seema Ghani works for a local NGO. She says they don't support laws that suppress women, regardless of religion.
We actually see it as a law that's limiting women's rights, and the Shia law, it's actually, even if it's a minority, we don't want to worry about that. No matter what religion we belong to, what sect we follow, we all stand against this law. We want a reform of the law, we want a revisit of it, an overturn of it.
Much has improved for women since the fall of the Taliban. Millions of girls now attend school, and many women own businesses. Of 351 parliamentarians, 89 are women. But the nation remains deeply conservative, and many fears those gains could be easily reversed. President Hamid Karzai faced a barrage of complaints following the law passage. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown said he had phoned Karzai to express his grave concern. French President Nicolas Sarkozy said NATO partners were unanimous in their demand that women's rights are defended and respected by the Afghan government. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper said there was now enormous pressure on the Afghan government to revoke the law. The United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan says it too has concerns but is waiting for the results of the review. Nila Mubaris is a member of the mission's media office.
It is possible that some of the provision in this law is inconsistent with the international conventions on the women's rights, and also maybe some of the provision in this law is unconstitutional. Also, you are aware that the president has ordered the review of this law, and the result has not been known yet, and it is premature to comment on that.
The Afghanistan Human Rights Organization says they do not have serious problem with the law, but some parts need more explanation. Hamidullah Hotak is an advisor for the organization. He says the article that tells a wife she must accept her husband's sexual advances if she is well comes from Islamic Sharia law.
Some human rights activists say sex should be made with the agreement of both the husband and wife. I agree with them. But if a wife is not ill and has no other problem and still gives a negative answer to a husband's sexual demands for months, what should a man do? There are too many women who do this.
Hamidullah says a man may be forced to look for sex elsewhere in these instances, and that too is illegal according to Islam. The Justice Ministry has yet to announce the findings of its review. Humayun Hamidzada is a spokesperson for President Karzai. He responded to international condemnation.
Now, we of course are sensitive to the concerns of our friends in the international community, but we are also accountable to our own people, to our own constitution, and to our own way of life. So what we are trying to do is to find the right balance. So we are confident that our Ministry of Justice is working on finding a way out that would be acceptable to us internally and also in line with our international obligations.
Hamidzada said they do not yet know when this balanced solution will be released. Zubair Babakar Khil, FSRN, Kabul.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback by dropping us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.